Good evening and welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, here on Countercurrents. Once again, I do want to thank the folks at Countercurrents for picking up this program. We had some issues with the Voice of Reason Network, where we used to do this show, which I'm sure everyone is familiar with by now. And the folks at Countercurrents have very graciously stepped in and taken over the production and hosting of this program, and that's very much appreciated. The program that we did last week was the inaugural program for the Countercurrents version of Attack the System. We had a young lady by the name of Tia Foster on the program, and that program, that interview, was by far the most well-received and probably received the most attention of any program we've done so far. So I'm definitely going to have her back on the program at some point to talk about some more stuff. But one thing she and I were actually talking about later after we did the interview was the question of what can we do as individuals to change things? You know, what can any individual do? I mean, movements can do things, organizations can do things, but what can an individual do on a personal level to change society or change the political system or change the world of ideas, intellectual discourse in the way that they want it to go. So I'm going to start by talking about that a little bit this evening and talk about some general trends that I see developing and where things might be headed in the future. I think it's a mistake for an individual to have the idea that it's up to them to change the world or to change the system or to change society, because that's really something that an individual can't do on their own. And I think that there are a lot of people out there that on one hand have an admirable idealistic vision of whatever it is they want to change, but at the same time they burn out, they get frustrated because they devote themselves to some particular project, and they say, you know, I've been doing this for years now, I've spent so much time on this, I don't feel like I'm getting anywhere with it. And I'm sure that many of the listeners that have been in different kinds of movements, whether it's the New Right or Alternative Right or something else, have probably experienced that on many different occasions. But I really think, though, that trying to judge the results of one's own effectiveness by the impact it has on society as a whole is not really the best way to go about judging what one has accomplished. Rather, I think a better way is to look at it in terms of what we can accomplish as individuals, because what we accomplish as individuals has the cumulative effect, the aggregate effect of impacting society. That's what changes society. That's what changes politics. That's what changes culture, is the cumulative, the aggregate effect of what we all do as individuals. No one person can change society. No one person can change the government. You know, certainly individuals can have a lot of influence, they can have impact, but it really takes a lot of different people. So the question to ask, I think, is not so much how can I as an individual change society, but what can I achieve as an individual that would contribute to the aggregate effect that will impact society in some direction that I want to see things move? Speaking from my own experience, as many listeners probably know, I came out of the radical left, and as a very young person, I became interested in the philosophy of anarchism, and of course on my blog and website, attackthesystem.com, and other places, I've spent a lot of time writing and talking about that. But I know when I was younger, when I was in my early 20s, this was like in the late 1980s, I was a part of the left-wing anarchist milieu. And back then, it was very similar to what it is now. It was very similar to the kinds of things that we see going on in movements like Occupy Wall Street. And before that, there was the anti-globalization movement back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Some of the things I was talking about and with Tia Foster on the last program, you know, in back in those years, I took a look at this radical left-wing anarchist subculture that I was a part of, And I identified certain weaknesses that I saw in that subculture and in that movement. And I set out to form an alternative movement or a new kind of movement that would take some of those same ideas, but perhaps shift their focus and incorporate some other ideas that would have a transformative effect, where we would really have a new kind of anarchist movement that that lacks some of the weaknesses that I saw in the older movement. And that's more or less what I've done. I mean, I see myself as having been successful at that project. And over the last decade or so, I mean, it took me a while to get there, obviously. It's something I've been working on for 20, 25 years. But over the last decade or so, myself and my colleagues at Attack the System and my colleagues from some other tendencies like the National Anarchist Movement or the National Anarchist Tribal Alliance of New York and a number of others have largely created the foundation for a whole new type of anti-state radical movement, but one that rejects, for example, the doctrinaire leftism and other kinds of problems that we find in the more mainstream, so-called mainstream anarchist milieu. And that's something that I've achieved as an individual. And likewise, in the process of trying to develop some of my own ideas, I've reached out to other movements, other tendencies, other people that might have some of the same ideas or people that I might agree with on certain points or might have some common concerns. And I've been able to reach out to a lot of people that come from my kind of background typically aren't able to reach out to. I know about a year or so ago, I spoke at the National Policy Institute, and that video is available, I think, on MPI's website. One of the things that I discussed there in that talk was the many common issues, common areas of interest that anarchists and nationalists might share. And in many camps on both the nationalist side and on the anarchist side, there are a lot of people who think that anarchists and nationalists ought to be enemies or are natural enemies, and that's not really the case at all. And because I've taken this kind of attitude over the years, one thing that I've been able to do is reach out and connect with people from a lot of different kinds of movements, different kinds of backgrounds that I would not have been able to have done if I wasn't able to be open-minded, if I wasn't able to encounter new ways of thinking and adapt to new ideas and hear different sides of arguments. So that's something that I have achieved as an individual. And as an individual, you know, I've been able to, look at my political community of origin, and that was the left-wing anarchist milieu, identify some of its weaknesses, go out and try to form alternatives, find other people interested in forming similar alternatives, and go and reach out to other people in other movements, other belief systems, try to find common areas of interest. And as a result, I've had some personal success in with some of those ideas. And that's what I'm about. I'm not about thinking about, well, how have I impacted society as an individual? You know, I as one person can't really change society. I can't really change the political system. I can't really change the broader culture. But what I can do is have personal success that contributes as part of the aggregate level of success to a wider movement. Now, a lot of people also get very frustrated when they see the amount of apathy that's out there in society. A lot of people say, well, you know, a lot of people just want to drink beer and watch football games and that kind of thing. They don't really care about anything important. And that's true. There's a lot of people like that. Probably all of us listening to this broadcast, the majority of the people we know fit that description. But I don't really think that matters that much, because in any kind of movement towards any kind of change, there's always going to be a minority that really drives the ship. Radical, political, social, cultural change is never made by the majority. It's always made by a militant minority, it usually starts out with just a handful of individuals who step up to the plate and say, hey, this is something that needs to be changed. And eventually other people get in line with that, and it's not always popular. You make a lot of enemies in the process when you do those kinds of things. But I know in my own case, I've seen the overall amount of political alienation and political dissent increase dramatically in my own lifetime. You know, I started out in political radicalism, dissident political movements of different kinds in the 1980s. It was the era of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan won election a couple of times by a landslide. You know, political dissent was not in vogue. I remember when I was probably about 23 or so, 22, 23 years old, I was hanging out on a college campus one time. And, you know, in those days, I was really into countercultural stuff. And I remember I was wearing a T-shirt. I don't know if I can really say what I had printed on the T-shirt, but it was F Authority. And, you know, like a good anarchist would. And I remember this co-ed came up to me and said, why do you have that printed on your shirt? And, you know, I had some, snappy response, like, why not, or something like that. And she said, well, this is the 80s. Why are you a rebel in the 80s? And, you know, that was a fairly insightful comment to the degree that it recognized, well, at the time, political dissent and cultural dissent of any kind was really something that was out of vogue. You were to be any kind of dissenter in those days made you something of an oddball. I mean, it does now as well, but it really did back then. But since then, in the years since then, I have really seen the amount of political dissent in this country, in the United States, grow dramatically over the last 20 years. You know, when I first started out doing political radicalism, I used to get the usual, well, if you don't like this country, go to Russia, things like that. You know, back in those days, the Soviet Union was still intact. The Cold War was still going on. And I think that actually the end of the Cold War had a lot to do with the growth of political alienation in our own society, because the state, the ruling class, no longer had the Soviet Union as this boogeyman that can hold out as a means of inspiring loyalty to the state and things like that. I think once that boogeyman was gone and, you know, American hegemony became unquestioned on a global basis, I think that one byproduct of that, that was a positive side effect, was that it opened the door for a greater amount of political dissent to emerge within the United States itself. So when we come back for the second segment, I'll talk a little bit about a number of trends that I see emerging in our own society that cause me to be optimistic, that cause me to think that there's going to be a whole lot more political dissent in the future, perhaps the not too distant future. So I'll be back in a second with all of that. Okay, welcome back to our second segment. I'm your host, Keith Preston, here for Attack the System on Countercurrents. I've been talking a little bit about how political change, social change, cultural change transpires, and I've been saying that if we personally feel that we have to go out and change all of this, then we're going to get really frustrated and we're going to feel like we're not getting anywhere. What matters is what we achieve as individuals, and the things that we achieve as individuals contribute to an aggregate social force that can make change happen. But we can't really take it upon ourselves to make change happen. We can only do what we do in our own little corners. But there's reason for optimism as far as greater dissent emerging, greater political change emerging. I talked a little bit in the previous segment about how I've seen the amount of political dissent grow in my own lifetime considerably, and there's a number of trends out there in our own society today that I think indicate there will be significant increase in the overall amount of political dissent and movements for cultural, social, political change in different directions. One of these is political unresponsiveness. What typically spears the growth of radical movements is when people have issues that they're concerned about. They go out, they try to work within the system, they try to play by the rules, they do all the things that their high school government courses told them they should do, and they find that the system doesn't work. And more people today, I think, are having that kind of experience. The way that the American political system works, I think the very best analogy would be to something like professional wrestling. For those of you that are familiar with professional wrestling, you know that you have a staged contest. You have these guys that are juiced up on steroids, and they're playing some kind of character typically. You know, they might wear a mask over their face or weird makeup, or they may have some kind of pretty boy image. But these you know, acrobats that are pretending to be combatants in these wrestling contests, they're playing characters that are pretending to be in conflict with one another, but the outcome is staged beforehand. And then when you watch these wrestling programs on television, you have these play-by-play announcers that are in on the game. They're essentially pretending like this is a contest, and even though they know perfectly well what the outcome is going to be, they know all of this is staged. And that's really, I think, the way the American political system works. You have the candidates that represent the two parties, and you know, one of them claims to be liberal, one claims to be conservative, and then they go on these media network programs, all these talking head networks like Fox and MSNBC and the ABC and CBS and NBC and all that. And they pretend like this is a real conflict. They pretend like this is a real contest, like there's real political choices out there, that there really are people that are trying to change the status quo. But in reality, they're all really working for the same team. They're working for the elite, the oligarchy that controls our own society. And the purpose of political campaigns and the purpose of the media coverage they receive is not to engage in free speech or present some sort of honest set of political choices. Rather, it's more like a sports contest. You've got the people out there who are loyal Republicans. You know, they think the fate of the world depends on whether or not Mitt Romney gets elected. You've got other people who are loyal Democrats, and you know, they think that the fate of the world depends on whether Obama gets reelected. But in reality, a lot of the people that really get caught up in that are no different than sports fans. I mean, they're simply rooting for their favorite team, and they're rooting for all the symbols and logos and things that are associated with their favorite team. But it ultimately means nothing as far as the direction that our society is heading, because all the political candidates, the political parties, they're all working for the same oligarchy that dominates our own society and has its own established agenda that it continues to pursue. The so-called democratic process and the media that hypes it is all for show. Now, we've seen the growth of these dissident political movements in recent years that I think serve a certain purpose. That they're all movements that I'm skeptical of in terms of their ability to really change anything, like the Tea Parties, like Occupy Wall Street, like the Ron Paul movement. I don't think any of those movements will ever amount to anything in terms of having any real impact on changing the system in any particular direction. But one thing that those movements do have the effect of doing is they have the effect of giving a lot of ordinary people who see that there are things out there that are wrong with society and want to do something about it and want to get involved. They give ordinary people the opportunity to go out, get involved in something, do something that they think is going to make a difference. And through participating in some of these things, like the Tea Parties, like the Ron Paul campaign, like Occupy Wall Street, what a lot of people who are new to activism, who are new to politics, who have high-minded ideals, what they are coming to understand is that the system does not work. For instance, there are some people who latched on to the Ron Paul campaign. And Ron Paul certainly raised many legitimate issues. The question of the constant expense of blood and treasure in aggressive foreign wars. The fact that the United States is going to face a monetary crisis at some point in the future due to inflationary monetary policies. Ron Paul was right about some of those things. The same with Occupy Wall Street. There's not much denying that the corporate elite have an unreasonable and excessive amount of influence over the government of the United States and over economic policy. And within the industrial system itself, within the corporate system, there are a lot of internal policies that are very damaging to individuals, to workers, to consumers, to families, to communities, and so forth. So many of the things that the Occupy Wall Street people were criticizing, many of the issues that they were raising were entirely legitimate. The same thing was true with the Tea Parties. The Tea Party people, a lot of them, the big issue seemed to be the debt economy. Fiscal conservatism was a popular issue with a lot of those people. And once again, they have a point. It's certainly not a good idea to have a society that's, you know, 15 or 17 or whatever trillion dollars in debt, to have an economy that's essentially driven by debt. That is a serious problem. And that's become a more serious problem in the last few years. So all of these different kinds of movements tend to be populated by a lot of people who are well-intentioned, well-meaning, have good ideas about things that they want to see changed. And what these movements do is they give people an opportunity to find out why working within the system doesn't work. The Tea Parties, for example, were essentially co-opted and essentially became a stooge movement for the neocons almost as soon as they were started. Now, the neocons, the leadership of the Republican Party, swooped in, brought those Tea Party groups right under the Republican umbrella, and really they're just another appendage to the neocon coalition now. The same thing with Occupy Wall Street. Right from the start, you had someone like Hillary Clinton asking that the Occupy Wall Street people say, oh, just let us know what your demands are. Sure, we'll accommodate you. And what they're trying to do is co-opt Occupy Wall Street and bring it into the Democratic Party coalition. As far as the Ron Paul movement, I actually think the Ron Paul movement was somewhat more anti-establishment than the other two movements, because it made foreign policy a centerpiece of its agenda. And I think that when you start talking about shutting down the American empire on an international level, you really are challenging ruling class power up to a certain level. And we see how the Republican Party establishment responded to that. I mean, the Republican Party establishment had zero interest in Ron Paul, even though he was a fairly popular candidate. So all of the people who have participated in these movements have gotten a sense, a certain type of political education. They've come to realize that working within the system simply doesn't work. Now, another trend that we see, and I think this is perhaps somewhat controversial. There's certainly arguments against what I'm going to say here. But I think it's true that political rebellion starts when liberalization begins after a certain period of repression. And I need to be clear as to what I'm talking about here. For example, in the Soviet Union, when perestroika and glasnost and some of those policies of liberalization began after the era of hardline Soviet rule, there tended to be an ever greater escalation of political dissent and political rebellion. And I think we're starting to see some of that now in our own society. And when I say liberalization, I'm not talking about liberal in the way that Americans think of liberalism, like a left liberal with a cliched set of ideas about, say, gun control or abortion or affirmative action or anything like that. I'm talking about liberalization as opposed to repression. More and more in public polls, I'm starting to see that the American public is starting to take a more quote-unquote liberal attitude about things like marijuana and marijuana decriminalization, gay marriage, these kinds of things, which is a big cry from the kind of stuff that we saw in the 1980s with the war on drugs being really intense and drug war rhetoric being the centerpiece of a lot of electoral campaigns, or in the 1990s when it was the war on crime and it was all about locking up more people, building more jails, putting more police on the street, or of course during the George W. Bush years where it was all about fighting the war on terrorism and those kinds of things. Now, I think it's a misperception to say that Barack Obama is someone who himself is for greater liberalization in the sense of less police state repression and things like that. I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, he's continued all of the policies that the neocons put into place under George W. Bush. But there is this perception. There's this perception that Barack Obama, he ran for office the first time as the candidate of hope and change and things like that. And I think that was inspiring to a lot of people. I think it's a big part of how he got elected, aside from things like demographic change and all of that. So there seems to be some evidence that the general culture is moving towards greater liberalization in the abstract sense. Another thing that tends to breed political rebellion is war that fails. There's plenty of historical precedent for that. For instance, in Germany, following the First World War, there was essentially a left-wing revolution. The traditional German monarchy was overthrown. A republic was put into place. There was the growth of a lot of radical movements from the left and from the right. In the United States, after the war in Vietnam, during and after the war in Vietnam, there was a lot of, as we know, a lot of political rebellion, a lot of cultural upheavals, and so forth. And now we have the situation with Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth, where the United States went to war. These wars have become increasingly unpopular over the years. They're commonly perceived of as having been, at bare minimum, a waste of time, a waste of life, a waste of expenditures, and many people view them as having been fought for fraudulent reasons or under false pretenses and so forth as well. Failed wars, wars that do not turn out well, wars that lead to political disenchantment, also tend to lead to dissatisfaction with institutions generally and the distrust of political institutions and political authority. Also, in more recent decades, we've seen the growth of more serious forms of political dissent. For example, I've seen some recent articles that indicate that some of the undercurrents of the radical populist right, like the militia movement and the sovereign citizens and some of those kinds of groups, you know, whether you agree with their ideas or not, some of those groups actually are now larger and have more adherents than they did in the 1990s. I used to see a lot of stuff about those groups in the 1990s in the media, particularly after the incident in Oklahoma City in 1995. But the evidence indicates that movements of that type are now actually much, much larger, or somewhat larger at least, than they were back then during their supposed heyday. Another thing that I've seen in recent years is an increased interest in the idea of secession. I saw a poll that was done by the Zogby Group about 4 years ago that showed that something like 25% of the American public felt like an individual state should have the right to secede from the Union, and something like 1 in 6 Americans might be open to the idea of their own individual state seceding from the Union. And you've never heard things like that when I first started out in radicalism back in the 1980s. I never encountered any modern secessionist groups until probably at the end of the 1990s, around the year 2000. So that's something else that's changed. Still another way in which dissent has grown has been the growth of the alternative right. There was no alternative right until a few years ago. You know, growing up in the United States in the 70s and 80s, in those days, the right was the Republican Party, period. And if you were on the right, you were a gung-ho, pro-American, patriotic, pro-Israel, pro-Cold War, whatever. When the Cold War ended, there began to be dissent on the right. You had the growth of the paleoconservatives, who were initially came along as a means of challenging the hegemony of the neocons, particularly over foreign policy issues. And out of the paleoconservative movement and some successor projects, there's emerged this alternative right movement, which really is something that's new, it's fresh, it's dynamic, it's unlike anything that certainly unlike anything that's existed in American politics in the past. And it really has a lot of interesting ideas in it that you don't find anywhere else. Still another thing that has contributed to the growth of political dissent, and I think will continue to do so in the future, is the overall economic downturn. The economic downturn that we've seen in recent years is not something that's going to be reversed. I really think the United States has seen its better years economically. The statistical data is overwhelmingly clear that divisions between the classes, between social classes, socioeconomic classes, is growing significantly to the point where if it continues, we're going to have the same kind of class system that you see in third world countries, where you have the very opulent, wealthy few at the top, and everybody else is poor, and you have a relatively small or very small middle class. That is the direction that our society is headed economically. So that's something else that certainly will breed economic, will breed political discontent. And I see I'm about out of time for our second segment here, so I'll be back shortly, and we'll continue discussing some of these questions. Okay, welcome back to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, here at Countercurrents. I'm talking about some of the trends that we see in our own society that give, at least to me, an indication that the overall amount of political dissent, of political alienation, is going to grow and probably grow significantly in the years and decades ahead. Some of the things I've talked about include the overwhelming unresponsive nature of the political establishment. I compared the political establishment to a professional wrestling match where the outcome is more or less staged from the beginning. Also, we've seen the rise of some of these activist movements like the Tea Parties, Occupy Wall Street, the Ron Paul campaign. A lot of people, for a lot of people who participate in those projects, that this is their introduction to political activism. And from this, they're going to get a political education. They're going to come to realize that the system doesn't work, and they're going to be open to more radical ideas. There's also some indication that there's a general shift in cultural attitudes towards greater liberalization in the broader sense. We don't really hear the rhetoric, the law and order rhetoric, for example, or the war on terror rhetoric that we heard over the last couple of decades. There's the failure of the wars. A lot of people now, probably the majority of Americans, see the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan as failures or as having unsatisfactory outcomes. Failed wars certainly lead to political dissatisfaction. We see the growth of more serious forms of dissent. I mentioned the growth of the sovereign citizen movements and militias and an increased interest in concepts like secession. There's also the growth of the alternative right. Before I signed off for the last segment, I talked about the overall economic downturn. When people are economically frustrated, they tend to be much more inclined towards political dissent. If the belly's full, if people are paying their bills, people can get the health care they need, things like that. If they're not worried about their children's future, they're not as going to be as inclined towards political dissent if they feel a great sense of economic security, but insecurity. But economic insecurity is going to be more and more the order of the day in the future. I mentioned how the gap between the social classes is widening, and that continues to grow over time. In American society, the gap between the socioeconomic classes is the widest of any, certainly any Western industrial societies, and one of the widest of any industrial society. And that, I think, is going to lead to more socioeconomic conflict at some point in the future. Now, I don't know what form it's going to take, and I don't necessarily think it's going to be the traditional Marxist form of class conflict where it's labor against management and that kind of thing, because that kind of model of class conflict is something of an anachronism in modern societies. But socioeconomic conflict is going to be a big thing in the future. Now, there's also demographic change, and that's something that a lot of listeners to Countercurrents, I know, are concerned about. And when we see radical demographic change to where there's no longer any kind of cultural or ethnic or racial or religious majority, but there's people tend to be splintered off into ethnic or cultural subgroupings, that tends to increase the overall amount of social alienation. There was, of course, the study that was published by a Harvard sociologist, Putnam, a few years ago, discussing how the lack of cultural bonds or the increased lack of cultural bonds in our own society has increased the amount of social alienation. There was a really interesting book put out a few years ago by a journalist named Bill Bishop called The Big Sort. And in this book, he pointed out how Americans are in the process of self-segregating by cultural and political and ethnic affiliation. He was going over the maps indicating how the vote goes, either for the red or the blue, and showing that the overall percentage of votes going for the red in the red states has grown significantly over time, and the same is true for the blue areas as well. What he meant by that is Americans are becoming more and more polarized on the basis of culture, religion, political philosophy, class, race, ethnicity, and lots of other things. And people tend to be grouping off into enclaves and becoming more and more polarized from other enclaves. That's a very interesting phenomena that's going on in our own society. When you have that kind of social alienation, and when you have a culture that's split up into a lot of competing factions, whether socioeconomic or racial or class or religious or whatever, it makes it much more difficult for the state and for the ruling class to retain popular loyalty and to maintain a veneer of legitimacy, because there's no common values that the ruling class can appeal to as a means of rallying people behind the state or behind the elite. So I think that in turn is going to increase the amount of political alienation that we see, the amount of political dissent that we see. Now, the big question that arises is, what will the next wave of political rebellion really look like? Will it be like a bigger version of Occupy Wall Street? Will it come from the left? Will it come from the right? I think that in the future, I actually think that any genuinely serious dissent will probably draw much more from the right than from the left. And the reason for that is the left is something of a spent force. And I don't really know that the left in its present incarnation is particularly radical or particularly anti-establishment. Like, if we look at the 1960s radical left, however we may want to assess its legacy, it was in many ways a genuinely anti-establishment movement. For example, in 1968, the radical left, the new left, the youth movement, the anti-war movement, they went to the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and they ended up getting into a rather messy street fight with the Chicago police. And this was the radical left fighting the police in the street at a convention of not the Republicans, the ostensible conservative party, but of the ostensible liberal party, the Democrats. I don't think you'd see that today. I don't think you'd see, say, the Occupy Wall Street going to a protest at a convention of Democrats, of establishment liberals, and end up getting into some sort of violent altercation. That might be possible that would happen at a Republican gathering. But I don't really see that happening. I wouldn't really see something like what happened in Chicago in 1968 repeating itself. But what that indicated, what happened in Chicago in 1968, is that you had a genuine radical left that was attacking the establishment and attacking the left wing of the establishment every bit as vehemently as it was attacking the right wing of the establishment. And what I've noticed about the alternative right and the radical right and the new right here in the on the populist right here in the United States in recent years is that it has become a type of permanent opposition right. The new right, the alternative right, the radical right is anti-establishment, no matter whether Democrats or Republicans are in power. In fact, if anything, a case could be made that a lot of new, certainly a lot of new rightists or alternative rightists that I know, if anything, seem to dislike the Republicans more than the Democrats. So this kind of alternative right that's emerged in recent years that's a permanent opposition right, I think in many ways represents what the next wave of more serious political dissent, serious political rebellion might be. Now, I do think that the right will be the primary source of any serious political dissent in the future. In the decades ahead, I think we're going to see a major increase in the amount of overall political rebellion in our own society. For a lot of reasons, some of the reasons I've discussed already on this program tonight and others. But I don't think it's going to be anything like what Americans typically think of as the right. I think, you know, I think much of the rebellion will come from the right, but it's not going to be the traditional American style right. One thing that I have found in my travels in alternative right circles in recent years is really how many fresh and new and dynamic and really interesting and unusual ideas there are among the radical right, among the alternative right. You know, I go to gatherings of the dissident right nowadays, and I meet people with all sorts of interesting philosophies and unique ideas, the things that I personally haven't even heard of before. And, you know, and I've been studying these things for a long time. So I think that the right of the future will differ considerably from past manifestations of the right, certainly in American politics. And in some ways, I think it will overlap with, in certain ways, with the left. Last week, when I had Tia Foster on the program, she was talking about her interest in animal rights and ecology and environmentalism and things like that. And we were talking about, well, that those kinds of issues are stereotyped as left-wing issues, but should they necessarily be left-wing issues? Why shouldn't people from the right take an interest in ecology or environmental preservation or in animal rights and things like that? And there are some who do. And I'm seeing an increase in the interest in those kinds of issues on the alternative right. Also, I think that as political dissent continues to escalate in our own society, as more and more people experience economic frustration, as more and more people try to work within the system to try to make change happen, I think that we're going to see a significant growth in dissident movements of all different types. I think that the real energy will come from the right, but I don't think the left is going away. In the late 1990s, early 2000s, we had movements like the anti-globalization movement. Then last year, the Occupy Wall Street thing came along, which was a very similar movement, only bigger. And it's quite possible that Occupy Wall Street is simply a prototype for a movement from the left that's going to be even bigger in the future. The same thing is true with the Tea Parties. I can see that kind of conservative grassroots populism continuing to grow and emerge in a more, in a bigger way. The Ron Paul movement, I think, has created the foundation for a new kind of radicalism with a libertarian or anti-state bent that may even be more radical than what the Ron Paul people are at present. So in some ways, some of these movements, while they've been failures, they've given people a political education about how working within the system doesn't work. At the same time, they may also be prototypes for other movements that are similar but perhaps bigger. For instance, imagine what would happen in our own society if all of these groups, if all the Tea Party groups, all the Occupy Wall Street groups, all the Ron Paul affiliated groups, all the alternative right or new right groups, all the militia and patriot and conspiracist and sovereign citizen groups, all the left-wing anarchist groups. Imagine if all of these different kinds of political dissident groups that are out there, and there's a ton of them, imagine if they all grew 100-fold or 1,000-fold. I think that's the way political dissent will unfold in our own society in the future. I think that there will be an escalation in the amount of political dissent, a significant escalation for reasons I've reviewed. But I think it'll take on a lot of different forms, and we'll see a lot of different tendencies pop up, each of them with their own ideas, their own issues, their own agendas. I think that the real energy, like I said, will come from the right. The left will still certainly be there. And we'll see a lot of new philosophies emerging and new ideas that are really sort of in the neither fish nor fowl category, where they don't really blend very well with either the traditional left or the traditional right, certainly not as those things are understood in our own culture. Also, I think another thing that will happen is as political dissent escalates, as the number of dissident political movements and organizations and tendencies escalates, so will the amount of infighting. All movements tend to have a lot of infighting within their own ranks. They tend to fight with other movements. as these kinds of movements grow and become more intense in some of their thinking, I think there's a possibility there'll be an increase in violence between different dissident political forces and between dissident political forces and the state. For instance, we see the example of these Antifa or Antifa groups. There was this incident in Chicago recently where some people were having a political meeting and some of these Antifa groups went in and attacked them physically. Most likely, I think that that kind of thing will continue in the future as well. As political dissent tends to grow, there will be more acts of private vigilantism against dissidents. That's something that tends to be fairly normal, you know, in societies where there's a lot of political upheaval, that vigilantism against political dissidents escalates. And the big question for me in all of this has always been, what is the end game? Where will our society, where will our civilization be in the future? There really aren't that many individual political issues that I personally have strong feelings about. You know, I can sit with someone for hours and discuss different issues and topics. And, you know, I can talk about abortion and capital punishment and animal rights and all different kinds of economic philosophies and, you know, gay marriage and a lot of different other things that people like to debate or argue about. To me, it's much more about the big picture. You know, I'm not really so much concerned about trying to promote one or another position on gay rights or one another position on capital punishment or one another position on abortion or this or that economic philosophy or whatever. Those really aren't my areas of interest. I'm interested more in what the future of our civilization itself will be. You know, will we have a civilization in America, in Europe, in the Western world generally? You know, I'm not worried about the Asian civilization. They seem to be doing fairly well, and I think in many ways the center of the world is moving away from the West towards the East. But as far as the future of Western civilization, I want to see a Western civilization that is thriving, that is creative, that is productive, that is prosperous, where there's, you know, a high culture, where there's excellence, where there's you know, all these kinds of basic human values, all these kinds of basic civilizational values. And that's what I'm concerned about. How are we going to preserve and protect that? How are we going to advance our own civilization in the future? What will come out of, you know, many of the problems that we see now, throughout all of the Western countries? We see incompetent and corrupt forms of government. We see economic decline. We see cultural and demographic transformation that has certain ominous implications. We see a lot of things of that type going on. What's going to be the end game with all that? You know, I've spent a lot of time studying the nation of Lebanon, which I think is an interesting country for a lot of reasons. For one thing, I'm very interested in the concept of fourth generation warfare, and I consider Lebanon's Shiite militia, Hezbollah, to be really one of the world's premier fourth generation military organizations. And for one thing, Lebanon is a country where a private military force has essentially replaced the state as the guardians of the nation. Hezbollah is Lebanon's military force for the most part. Also, in Lebanon, you had a situation in the late 70s, early 80s, where their society was completely fractured along sectarian lines, and there was a bloody, you know, multiple faction civil war that went on for years there. To some degree, the way that that was solved was through the implementation of a political system there that they call it a confessional system, where different political factions, different religious factions and so forth are guaranteed certain seats and a certain amount of representation in the government. And I really see our own society, certainly in the United States, and I think to some degree in the West, as having to necessarily move towards a system like that in the future. You know, I think that as the economy goes under, the military-industrial complex itself will go under. I think we'll see perhaps the rise in private forms of security and protection. Martin Van Creveld, a major military theorist, has written a bit about that. And I think we'll see this kind of increased splintering and fracturing along cultural and demographic and religious and ethnic and racial and other kinds of lines. And the question is, how are we going to deal with all of that in the future of the United States and the future of Western civilization? Those are the issues that I write about and talk about on this program. I've got a lot of material about that on attackthesystem.com. My colleagues there try to address some of these issues. If you'd like to check that out, please feel free to check out our website, attackthesystem.com. It would also be very nice if you felt like donating to our site and supporting our work. You can go to our website and click on the donate link at the top. Any support is always welcome. The more support we get, the more we can do. So until next week, thank you for tuning in and listening to this podcast. This is Keith Preston for Attack the System.